Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm really happy to be here. I'm the principal and founder of a company called Taper & Tine, and I've been in user experience and interaction design for about 15 years. I'm a little bit more of a front of the stage kind of speaker, so this is kind of a barrier between me and you. I'm most passionate about empowering creative leaders to inspire their teams to make great products and services. And I've spent a lot of the last 5 to 6 years really studying collaboration and how people work together. If you're Twittering, please use hashtag creative leaders, and I'm Sarah B with 3 E's. So thanks. So we're just going to just go right into it. There should be audio.
Is starting hard?
You know it is. I don't know what you do when you start, but I clean my desk. I make a lot of stupid appointments that I make sound important. Avoidance, delay, denial. I'm always scared that I'm not going to know what to do. It's a terrifying moment. And then when I start, I'm always amazed. Oh, that wasn't so bad.
Has anybody seen this? Do you know what it is? Yeah, it's the, thank you. Sketches of Frank Gehry, and this is a great documentary about how he works. The reason that I like to start with this is because I think it's such a succinct overview of the creative process, where you start with the terror of the blank page, and then your brain starts working. You have to do other things while your brain is working on a problem, and you make the first mark, and then the mark turns into something, and then the production, and at the end you have this amazing thing that you didn't know you could have at the beginning, right? I feel like that's the creative process, and he describes it so well. The other thing that I like to talk about is this documentary is called Art and Copy, and it's about the history of the advertising industry. And this is the very opening quote, which says, "The frightening and most difficult thing about being what someone calls a creative person is that you have absolutely no idea where your thoughts come from, and you have no idea where they're going to come from tomorrow." Does that resonate with anybody? A little bit? Little bit? Just a little bit? Okay, yeah. Okay, so creative leaders, then what's your job? Right? As someone who leads creative teams, what's your job? Especially if you come from a making background, right? And now you're a leader or a manager and you don't necessarily make anymore. So this is one of my favorite books on creative leadership. It's Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. It's actually awesome. And she has this quote in here, and it says, "You would think as a producer your job would be to churn up creativity, but mostly your job is to police enthusiasm." Does that feel resonate? Yeah, a little bit. So the example that she gives is when the script calls for a piece of chocolate cake on a white plate, and props department gets super excited, and they come in with this like beautiful china plate that they've picked up in the Lower East Side someplace, and this like Magnolia Bakery cake, you know, that's like perfectly buttercream, whatever. When the script really just calls for a piece of chocolate cake on a plate, right? So you say to your person, "God, that is so great. You are so creative. Holy crap. Thank you. But what I really need you to do is go back and get me a white plate with a piece of chocolate cake on it," right? Because a lot of what the job of the creative leader is to translate between different kinds of needs, right? So sometimes I think about creative people as being kind of immigrants into a new country, which is business, right? And so there are two cultures, business and creative. And by the way, when I say creative, I include developers and all of that, anybody who's making something new, right? Who's making something new. So, but cultures have different languages. They have different values. They have different cultures and customs and behaviors as well. And so if you think of business as a language, if it had the punctuation of it is often exclamation marks and periods, right? So it's about efficiency. It's about certainty. It's about knowing, predictability, repeatability, right? There's a, and it's also, you know, I think certainty is the thing that I would underline. But in creative language, we're a lot about question marks and pauses. So we ask questions. What if? What are the possibilities? How might we experiment? We're okay, typically, with failure as well, because that's part of the creative process. As you can see, these things are, it's a bit of a culture clash, right? So creative leader often sits between these two places, right? So what I want you to do, just briefly, is to close your eyes. I'm looking out to make sure you're doing it. Okay. So take a couple of really deep breaths. Just breathe in, breathe out. South by Southwest is a crazy place. This is at least, if you get nothing else out of this session, you get a couple of minutes to just be quiet, right? So I want you to sit back and kind of imagine you're at your desk in your job, right? Really put yourself there. What's on the desk in front of you? What does the seat feel like underneath you? And I want you to kind of bring into your mind what is your biggest challenge, the biggest challenge you face right now in your role, in your company. Okay, just kind of bring that in your mind. Don't do anything with it, just kind of acknowledge it. Okay, so now open your eyes again. So I'm curious, how many of you think this, that your biggest problem is a process problem? Oh, good, good, good. Okay, a couple, okay, good. That's good, that's good. How about a technical problem? Okay. How about a people problem? You know what the answer is, of course, I'm looking for, which is I actually think most of our problems are actually people problems. It's interesting. I really do. And I think that, you know, I think that in this industry, we try to diagram people problems in the hopes that we'll be able to transform the messiness of human interaction into something we can wrap our arms around, something that's easy to understand, right? Spend a lot of time with the process diagrams. And I am someone who, I speak from experience. You talk about the things you need to learn about the most, right? So what I want to share with you is this idea of clouds and clocks. How many of you are familiar with Karl Popper? Okay, a few. Okay, good. I'm learning and I'm very fascinated. So Karl Popper wrote, he was a scientist and a philosopher, and he wrote an essay called Of Clouds and Clocks. And in that, he described two kinds of problems that he saw. The first one is, unsurprisingly, a clock problem. So clock problems are knowable problems. They're measurable. So you think of a clock. Like, you can understand, you can deduce the function of a clock by the sum of its parts. You can pull it apart. You know what it's supposed to do. It's a knowable, quantifiable problem, right? Clouds, on the other hand, are not something you can necessarily, like literally you can't wrap your arms around them, right? They're constantly changing. You can model clouds. You can model cloud formations. You can look at things like atmosphere, and you can look at things like moisture, and you can look at a number of things to try to predict how a cloud is going to act. But it's never one thing at one time, right? It's constantly changing. So that's fine. So we've got two kinds of problems. But what the real issue is, as Popper would say, is that when we take cloud problems and we try to treat them like clock problems, does that? So if I even go even more like very specific, is that we take the kind of the complexity of design, the complexity of creativity, with all of its aspects, and we try to kind of condense it into something that we can understand, right? Because that's what we do. Human beings, we're comfortable with reductionist thinking. That's like we like to put stuff in boxes. Because it does help us process the world. You know, I just sort of think about, like, this is kind of what process really looks like. And then here's one I made. How is it so easy? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 steps, right? And I'm not to say that roadmaps are a bad idea, because it's good to have some model that you can all move around. But they're not all that's to it. And in addition, I think, so humans do this anyway, right? But in addition, we're in an environment and an industry where we use machines that take input and output. And so there's been some history in like human-computer interaction of trying to do the same thing with people, breaking everything down into tasks, taking things out of their context, right? Trying to make people more like machines. So that's what, you know, the rise of human experience. But again, it's just a very messy. And I love the messiness of humans because this is where creativity really happens. New ideas happen, innovation happens, is when you allow for a little bit of anarchy, right? When there's a little bit of space for a new idea to kind of shift something, or you allow for serendipity, right? If you structure something too much, you might lose that opportunity. So what, right? I always come to talk sometimes and you're like, okay, that's really great theory, and what the hell does that mean for me? So what I've been doing and what I encourage you to do is to change the way that you think about teamwork and how you think about teams. So again, like, think of it as a system that you nurture, right? That you kind of are constantly developing and looking at the different aspects, culture, behavior, tools, processes. These are all kind of parts of this whole beautiful system, right? And then model the culture that you want to have. One of the best ways that you can improve people processes and people problems is to model the behavior, especially if you're in a leadership position. You're in a place that people, they attach a lot more meaning to your actions, right? So modeling the culture that you want to have through everything that you do will be one of the fastest ways that you can actually shift, easier ways that you can shift things. Change in with people is not fast. So you sort of start with you, right? And you become, and one of the things I think is really important is that you become emotionally literate. You learn what's going on within yourself, become self-aware, right? You learn how to manage your emotions and understand the effect that you have on other people. Gaining a sense of social awareness. So how do people interact with each other? And what are their, you know, what are their kind of emotional needs as well? And then learn more about relationship management. Now this is a really like easy little list. Just tick this off, just do it. This is a lifelong pursuit, right? Getting to know yourself. But once you know yourself really deeply, you can be the most service to the people around you. And you can actually more likely model the behavior that you want to see. So tactical. Here's an example. So let's say, for instance, that you want to have a culture of open communication, and you also maybe want to have some evangelism. So your team, a UX team or a design team, is doing great work, but nobody in the company understands it or knows it. So is it your job to go out and be the lone evangelist who's trying to, like, you know, fight your way through the crowds? Or can you engage your team in the process? So this is actually a client of mine is doing this with her team meetings. So rather than just kind of going through a status update, she does that, but at the end of it, she does this thing, which is basically ask two questions. What are we doing well, and what can we share with our business partners? Which seems really simple, and it is really simple, but the first thing it does is it focuses on the positive. Everybody loves to bitch, so you actually intentionally say, what is it we're doing really well? And then you translate that into some action. How can we share this? What's really interesting about what's happening with her is that people are starting to see their responsibility and their power in actually bringing their practice out into the rest of the world, right? So she's empowering them through this very simple act, right? And she doesn't have to do it. Now they all want to do it. So you can think of that in other ways. I think a lot about cross-pollination, like bees. But that if you want to bring more innovative ideas, bring people together. You can do this in simple ways, too. Yes, you can have brown bags, but you can also have, like, a TED Talks once a month kind of a thing. Or you can have somebody, like, do a book report. There's all kinds of ways that you can do to bring in new ideas. Keeping it really, really simple. You don't have to come up with a big innovation program. Just keep something really, really simple. And the last thing I'll say is play. I think I have always underestimated the power of play, but your teams need to have a chance to do some undirected creativity that doesn't necessarily has to have a measurable outcome, right? There needs to be a chance for people to play. There's all kinds of games that you can play. There are all kinds of things on the internet. I'm really fascinated with Oliver Herring's Task right now. You can look that up. But look for ways to play and encourage people to play, right? And I think at the end, just remind yourself that design and creativity is not a destination, but that it's a journey. It's a process. It's a progress, not perfection, right? There's no place you're going to go where it's going to be perfect. Just kind of keep moving in directions towards it and love the moments of perfection that you experience on the way. So that is my little talk. The slides are up at Taper and Tyne, T-A-P-I-R and Tyne.com/speakingandwriting.html. And I just thank you very much for your 12 minutes of attention. And I hope that you have a good time at South by Southwest.